4. Saidi smiled as he listened to Mahmood recount what happened to him the previous day in Brigadier Majid's office. When he got to the part about the weak tea, Saidi burst out laughing. He took it lightly as usual. There wasn't a disaster in the world that could change his mood. There he was, as well-dressed as ever, clean-shaven and scented with expensive perfume, sitting behind his massive desk as if he were about to appear on a television program. Fareed Shawaf came in with the first proofs of the magazine's political news section, which he was responsible for. He put them in front of Saidi, who asked him to show them to Mahmood. Fareed sensed the change that had come over his old friend Mahmood, and yet he didn't want to submit to him as he would to a real editor-in-chief, or he was trying to head off any chance of that happening. He spread the pages in front of Mahmood and waited for him to comment. Mahmood said the layout was good. He said this with difficulty, because he too didn't want to seem condescending. Fareed went out, and some other young men came in. Then the old janitor entered with two cups of Nescafe. A certain silence reigned in Saidi's office after they all had left. Saidi stood up, went to the window, pulled aside the curtain, and looked out onto the street. He turned to Mahmood and said, "Brigadier Majid is one of the people you'll have to get used to dealing with." Mahmood said nothing, but waited for further explanation, because he didn't plan to see Brigadier Majid and would try as far as possible to make sure that kind of meeting didn't happen again. "There are people like him in our world," said Saidi, "and we have to learn how to deal with them tactfully, how to get along with them, how to accept that they exist." Saidi went back to looking out from behind the curtains, as if he was expecting someone. He stayed like that for some moments, then came and sat on the sofa opposite Mahmood. He picked up his cup of Nescafe and started to drink, enjoying its bitterness. Then he looked at Mahmood and made a dramatic revelation. "In fact, Brigadier Majid doesn't pursue weird crimes. He's employed by the Americans' Coalition Provisional Authority to lead an assassination squad."
"Assassination squad?"
"Yes, for a year or more he's been carrying out the policy of the American ambassador to create an equilibrium of violence on the streets between the Sunni and Shiite militias. So there'll be a balance later at the negotiating table to make new political arrangements in Iraq. The American army is unable or unwilling to stop the violence. So at least a balance, or an equivalence of violence, has to be created. Without it, there won't be a successful political process."
"Why don't you tell your political friends about this?" asked Mahmood.
"They all know, but no one has definitive proof. Or they look at the tracking and pursuit department that Brigadier Majid heads as if they're looking at a text. Each party interprets it according to its own interests."
"Could Brigadier Majid really be so brutal? He seems like a pleasant man."
"Just a minute ago you were calling him cruel and evil. How come he's suddenly pleasant?"
"What I mean is, he doesn't seem like a criminal in the way you've just described him, as the head of an assassination squad. That's hard to believe."
"Anyway, the best way to protect yourself from evil is to keep close to it. I humor him, so he doesn't stand in the way of my political ambitions, and so he doesn't put a bullet in the back of my head, fired by one of those fat guys with shaved heads in response to an order from the Americans."
"My God, it's serious business."
"As long as he's our friend, there's nothing to fear from him. Didn't you say he was laughing with you and talking about smoking? Don't worry about him. He's a nice guy."
"A while back I said he's a nice guy and you got upset."
"Yeah, never mind. Nice, pleasant, funny. That's tea story."
Saidi kept laughing, and Mahmood smiled. But inside Mahmood felt a growing sense of unease and fear. An unknown enemy loomed large. It was an enemy he thought he had left in Amara, but now it was active in Baghdad. Although he trusted Saidi, he couldn't believe everything he said. Maybe Saidi wanted to frighten him, or tease him, or place him in hypothetical situations in order to get him thinking, to create a kind of challenge to bring out his hidden talents or achieve some other clever, calculated outcome. A few minutes later, the janitor knocked on the door and told the editor he had a visitor. A dark, slim young woman with dyed hair came in, wearing jeans and lots of accessories. Her exotic perfume filled the room. It wasn't Nawal al-Wazir. She was more flamboyant than Nawal, livelier and younger. She shook hands with Saidi, and they exchanged kisses on both cheeks. Saidi didn't bother to introduce her to Mahmood, But she shook Mahmud's hand anyway and enthusiastically kissed him, too, on both cheeks. Saidi and the woman had an appointment, so Saidi picked up his leather briefcase, and they prepared to leave together. Saidi looked at Mahmud and reminded him of what to do with the magazine.
"Be a hero, my friend, okay?"
he said with a smile and a wave goodbye. 5. A week later, Saidi traveled to Beirut, maybe with the thin dark woman or some other thin woman, leaving Mahmud swamped, not just with editing 45 pages of the magazine, but also with an endless succession of administrative details, signing receipts, giving the staff their pay, and meeting people who suddenly turned up at 9 o'clock in the morning looking for Saidi to ask for a job or for some other reason. He took the calls that came in on the cell phone connected to the charger, announcing themselves with numbers and abbreviated names in English, and sometimes just two or three letters, such as T.Y., who was Talib Yahya, the manager of Ansam Printing, which printed the magazine and which Saidi had once thought of buying. C. was a woman who gave Saidi the title of Haji. Mahmud didn't know what kind of relationship she had with Saidi. There were many doctors, Dr. Adnan, Dr. Saber, Dr. Fauzi, all of them officials in Parliament or the office managers of parliamentarians or spokesmen for political groups. SM was an easy abbreviation. That was Surur Majid, the brigadier, who called from time to time. Mahmud guessed there was another level to the relationship between the two men that Saidi hadn't spoken about yet. They had common business or financial interests, and all the talk of astrologers and fortune-tellers, and then the story of the assassination squads, was just camouflage. But none of these things affected the way Mahmud saw Saidi. He always found excuses for him. He admired him. Saidi was a real Superman, albeit without supernatural powers, but with his own human talents. Mahmud made excuses for the mysterious aspects of Saidi's personality because no one knew whether Saidi's mystique stemmed from a need to protect himself or whether it was derived from myths others had created about him. Like Saidi, Mahmud wasn't immune to the seductions of illusion. He had assumed many of the traits of the man who inspired and mentored him. He had put on weight. He shaved every day. He wore suits and ties and colored shirts, though he and his friends Farid Shawaf and Adnan Al-Anwar used to make fun of such men, associating suits with politicians and civil servants, as well as with the militiamen in natty suits who would jump out of their vehicles in the middle of the street to drag people out of their shops or cars and beat them up or abduct them. But everything changes, and those who don't wear suits don't appreciate the advantages. Farid Shawaf made fun of the transformation of his old friend and thought that Mahmud had started to cross to the other side. When Mahmud laughed off such talk, Farid admonished, "You're getting more and more like them. You're trying to be one of them. Anyone who puts on a crown, even if only as an experiment, will end up looking for a kingdom." Mahmud now very much resembled Saidi. One day, sitting behind Saidi's desk and talking to his colleagues, he noticed he was even holding a cigar the same way Saidi did, as if it were a thick pen. He also peppered his speech with, "my dear," and "my friend," just like Saidi. But he wasn't really like Saidi, said a voice in his head. Not very much like him at all. Saidi had a fortune, though no one knew how big it was, and multiple sources of income, and this magazine was just a front, whereas Mahmud was dependent on his salary, without which everything would fall in on his head. Before the end of the workday, the cell phone that Saidi kept in his office rang. Mahmud picked it up and saw 666 on the screen, and the image of Nawal came into focus in front of him. "Hello?" he said. Silence. "Don't be childish," he continued. "I know who you are, and Baher's away in Beirut. Speak." Chapter 12. In Lane 7. 1. Abu Anmar stood on the sidewalk and looked across the street at the Rasul real estate office. A sense of gloom came over him. Faraj the realtor had put up a new sign. He was doing well for himself. Meanwhile, Abu Anmar couldn't understand why his hotel business was in constant decline. He hadn't had a real guest in a month or more, other than his two permanent guests. Even Hazem Aboud came only now and then to take pictures of the balconies that were collapsing and the coats of paint that were flaking off the walls. He might sit down to have a cup of tea with Abu Anmar, but since the summer he had practically stopped spending the night at the hotel. On Hazem's last visit, Abu Anmar told him, with some enthusiasm, that he was working on renovating the hotel. Hazem noticed that many of the rooms no longer had any furniture. Abu Anmar didn't tell him how hard he had had to negotiate with Hadi the junk dealer. If he had had any alternative, Abu Anmar would have kicked him out the door rather than submit to his tiresome bargaining. What Hazem didn't know was that Abu Anmar couldn't replace the carpet in the lobby with the shabby wooden table at which he usually sat. He couldn't replace a single broken window, or repair the leaks or blockages in the pipes and the sewerage. He couldn't even buy a bottle of air freshener to cover up the smell of rot and mold. He was getting rid of the hotel furniture in order to stay alive, to eat. Abu Anmar didn't know what he would do, but he was prepared to be adventurous and take a risk if necessary. He had to stand on his own two feet and not let anyone see him as a laughingstock, especially that bastard with the mustache and the hennaed beard who was sitting at his polished desk behind the clean front window of his air-conditioned office, looking out at him morning and evening from the other side of the street. 2. Since the what's-its-name had stopped visiting, Hadi had gradually gone back to being his usual self. Some people felt he was more like his old self than ever, even to the point of excess, as if he were trying to make up for having stayed out of the public eye in recent months. At his old space by the big front window of Aziz's coffee shop, Hadi told a new story about meeting the Iraqi president on a street in Jadriya the night before. An armor-plated black Mercedes stopped, and the driver got out and rushed to the other side to open the door for the president, who was extremely fat. The president put his right foot on the pavement, but his body stayed slumped in the back seat. Hadi ignored the car and kept walking with his canvas sack of empty soda cans.
"Hadi! Hadi!" called the president. "Yes, Mr. President. Can't you stop telling your stories? Stop talking about us. There's nothing we can do, and you're going to start a revolution against us. What can I say, Mr. President? Do your job properly, and I won't tell stories about you. Why don't you come along with me? Come. Let's make a deal. They've made us a good dinner in the green zone." "No, Mr. President, I'm not hungry. But if there's arak, I'll come. Do you drink arak, Mr. President?" "Shame on you. I drink distilled water. You should quit telling your stories, Hadi."
The president laughed and shut the car door, and then the car drove off down the street and disappeared. Most people just laughed at these little scenes with which Hadi embellished his stories. Once someone had shown him a copy of Al-Aqiqa magazine with a picture of a disfigured Robert De Niro on the cover. In it was Hadi's story about the what's-its-name, with details that had never been part of the story. Hadi's name didn't appear in the story, but Aziz the Egyptian and some of the regulars at the coffee shop knew Mahmoud al-Sawadi, who had written the story, and knew that Hadi was his source. Turning the pages without any reaction on his dry, wrinkled face, Hadi said the journalist had made up parts of the story. Hadi felt exploited. Mahmoud had promised he would act in the what's-its-name's interests and treat him fairly. 2 days later, Hadi received his last visit from the what's-its-name, who came to his house at night to tell him about the civil war between his followers and to say that the Americans had again sealed off the area where he had been living and had tried to arrest him several times with help from a special missions unit of Iraqi intelligence, forcing him not to stay in one place for more than a day. As for the story the journalist had written about him, it hadn't done him much good. It had portrayed him as a figment of Hadi's sick imagination. The what's-its-name was looking for believers, who would facilitate his work, and wouldn't use their belief in him for their own purposes, as the three madmen and their followers had done. He didn't want to be turned into just an urban legend, as the journalist had portrayed him. Hadi promised the what's-its-name that he would pass this on to the journalist when he saw him, but the what's-its-name said it didn't matter any longer. "There's no harm in warning him so it doesn't offend me again. I'm now taking revenge on people who insult me, not just on those who did violence to those whose body parts I'm made of, the what's-its-name said. Hadi never again saw his creation after that. He knew the big criminal the Americans and the Iraqi police were looking for, and who was always mentioned on television, was the what's-its-name. He and the what's-its-name were linked only in his mind, and maybe in the mind of Mahmoud al-Sawadi. But eventually, Brigadier Majid, pacing anxiously around his spacious office with a fat cigar in his mouth, lost in thought about the best way to track down the one who has no name, as that fortune-teller with the pointy beard called him, eventually, he made the connection. 3. Faraj was sitting behind his desk in the real estate office, carefully monitoring the door of the Aruba Hotel across the street. He knew all Abu Anmar's routines by heart, and knew the financial straits he was in. Abu Anmar emerged through the hotel door, swung his vast frame around to close the door behind him, then slowly descended the 3 steps to the sidewalk. He adjusted his headcloth on his shoulders and walked off, twirling his string of big shiny prayer beads around his fat hand like a propeller. Before he passed the Akawain laundry next door, a hand touched him on the shoulder. He turned to find Faraj, with his thick red beard, smiling at him. The narrow gap between him and his rival unnerved Abu Anmar. For the first time, he noticed 2 large moles on Faraj's face, one at the inner end of his left eyebrow, apparently inflamed, and the other right above his thin mustache. "Go and finish your errands, and then drop in and have a cup of tea with me," Faraj said. "Inshallah," replied Abu Anmar, twirling his beads faster and giving a quick nod of his head. Abu Anmar quickened his pace, and Faraj went back to his office, rubbing his chin. He seemed energetic and relaxed. That morning he had slapped a thin young man with unkempt hair and a goatee beard, sending him spinning before collapsing to the ground. The young man was a member of the Association for the Protection of Historical Houses. He had gone to Alishva's house, and she had welcomed him in and given him a cup of tea, according to Salim. Someone had come running to tell Faraj, who hurried to the lane to find the man sticking his head out of Alishva's house and taking out his camera to snap photos of the Mashrabiya balconies of Salim's house. Abu Salim, Salim's husband, put his head out of the window on the second floor and stared in amazement at the young man, who took another picture, as if Abu Salim's appearance enhanced the traditional ambience of the old house. He felt someone approaching, and turned and saw Faraj's angry face. Then came the resounding slap. Faraj's assistants picked up the young man and gave him a shove. He hurried off and looked behind him to see them waving him away, while some of them held Faraj back to keep him from running after the poor young man. Faraj dusted off his clothes and straightened his skullcap. He turned and saw Alishva looking through the gaping doorway. Her face was pale and tired, more like that of a ghost than of an ordinary woman. Faraj raised his hand and waved it in front of her face.
"Won't you drop dead already and give me a break? You're as tough as old boots, for God's sake," he said.
Faraj went back to his office, and the slap he'd planted on that poor thin young man continued to echo down the lane. Less than an hour later, Abu Anmar returned to his hotel with some black shopping bags. Faraj shouted to one of his young workers and sent him to the hotel to remind Abu Anmar of their appointment. It would be Abu Anmar's first and last time in Faraj's office. He hadn't known it was so grand and spacious. His emotions swung between envy at the wealth of his rival and surrender to the sensory effects of the office's opulence. The young servant put a cup of tea in front of Abu Anmar and another in front of Faraj, and amid the clatter of spoons, Faraj got straight to the point.
"Abu Anmar, you're very dear to me. You're a professional, and you understand business. I'd like us to work together, you and I."
"Okay. What did you have in mind?"
"Good, good. I've noticed what a terrible state your hotel is in. It's going to waste."
"I'm hoping to have it renovated," said Abu Anmar.
"With what, Abu Anmar? Where will you get the money?"
"God is generous."
"Yes, God is generous. No need to be embarrassed, my brother Abu Anmar. I know very well that you don't have a penny.
I'm your brother. Don't be shy with me. I mean, I'd like us to be partners, you and I. I'll take on the cost of renovating the hotel and furnishing it, and we'll be partners. Half and half. What do you say?
4.
Where are you from? Asked Hadi.
We're from the traffic department, the two officers in pink politely replied.
Hadi was sitting on his bed in the middle of the courtyard as the sun set in the west. The officers, along with some assistants, had raided Hadi's house, sent by Brigadier Majid.
But I haven't committed any traffic offenses for 2 years, said Hadi. And besides, I don't have a car.
Are you making fun of us, sir? Replied one of the officers, who had a thick bandage around his neck.
Hadi had no way of knowing that it was this officer whom the what's-its-name had tried to throttle on that terrible night of the chase. And now he was apparently trying to work out whether Hadi was the same height and had the same physique as the monster who had almost killed him. Taking hold of Hadi's arms, he thought this scrawny old man wouldn't be agile enough to run or put up much of a fight. But he wasn't quite certain.
Playing the hero and resisting the Americans, are you?
I'm a junk dealer. Look around you.
Hadi pointed at 10 wooden wardrobes lined up against the wall.
Yes, of course. You could always open a bureau for terrorist services, car bombings, and assassinations with silencers.
Silencers?
Go ahead. Pretend to be innocent.
They left Hadi and went off to search his room. A powerful stench hit them in the face. His things were in piles, and there was a small mound of Heineken beer cans in the corner. There were shoes, jugs made of copper, aluminum, and plastic, wooden tables with broken legs, clothes, pigeon and chicken feathers, bed covers and faded blankets, a stove, 2 gas cylinders, a plastic barrel full of kerosene, and a cupboard littered with onions, garlic, empty milk cans, and tins of fish and beans. They quickly left, then surrounded Hadi's bed again and resumed their questions about the crimes he was committing in the streets of Baghdad. A plaster statue of the Virgin Mary, her arms spread in a gesture of peace, and with faded touches of color on her long dress, had caught the officer's interest.
Are you Christian? Asked one of them.
No, I'm Muslim.
So what's this statue of the Virgin Mary for?
I don't know. There was a copy of the throne verse on top of it. The inscription fell apart and the statue appeared.
My God, you're a story.
What are you going to do with her?
The officer with the bandage around his neck asked threateningly. And then the guys from the traffic department began to question Hadi about crimes he knew nothing about, asking him about a corpse, or what's-its-name, in a fictional story he had made up to please the people sitting around him, to make himself more popular among the local people so they would like him and sympathize with him.
Are you completely sane?
Hadi asked in a sudden display of courage, frustrated by the interrogation.
What corpse? But what's its name? What are you talking about? Now you're making up a horror film to attack me with, all because of a made-up story, some coffee shop talk.
Hey, don't get fresh with us, or else I'll give you a good pummeling,
threatened the man with the bandage. The other pink officer held his arm to calm him down and took charge of the interrogation. They continued to pace around Hadi's bed, asking him questions even after people's faces had become difficult to make out in the dark. The voices become harsher, and hands Hadi couldn't identify pushed him onto the bed several times. Then one of them gave Hadi a sharp thump on the face, and he fell to the ground, hitting his head on one of the few intact floor tiles among the loose and broken ones. The interrogation had taken a new turn, one that was commonplace in all Iraqi police stations. Hadi had heard many stories about it from other people. 2 assistants lifted Hadi's arms, and the pink officer with the bandage started punching Hadi in the stomach like a madman. This went on for 2 full minutes. The punches didn't stop until Hadi threw up the beans and vegetables he had eaten at noon and the 2 cans of Heineken he had drunk an hour before the officers had burst in on him. The foul-smelling mixture soiled the clothes of the officer, who jumped back, cursing and swearing. The 2 goons who had been holding Hadi's arms let go of him and left him to fall to the ground to continue vomiting. An hour later, in darkness punctuated by the glow of his colleague's cigarettes,
The calmer of the two officers concluded that the junk dealer was just an old liar, degenerate, and half crazy. He might be protecting a real criminal, but the officer felt that taking him to the police station would just complicate the case they were investigating. He decided to leave this old drunk where he was, and never to visit him again, but to have a few people monitor him to see who visited him and who he met. He should feel at ease, and not be afraid he was being watched. The officer's assistants switched on some powerful electric lamps, lighting the place up. Hadi was lying on his back on the courtyard floor. He didn't seem able to get up. The officers searched the place again. In a glass coffee jar on the dining table, behind the piles of onions, they found the small amount of cash Hadi had made from selling Abu Anmar's furniture in the Harj market. The calmer of the two officers put the money in his pants pocket, then picked up some other things at random. He took a table made of metal and wood, and others picked up pieces of furniture and various antiques, a broken chandelier, a wooden wall clock with a pendulum behind a glass window. One of the assistants, after daring to venture deep into Hadi's room, found a set of plates in a cardboard box, with pictures of King Ghazi and King Faisal II, and of Abdul Karim Qasim, Baghdad Central Station, and other historical sites and nature scenes. He picked up the cardboard box, took it out to his friends, and opened it up with a sense of triumph. They behaved like thieves. The calm officer, wanting to add to Hadi's confusion about who they were, gave Hadi a warning.
"That statue of the Virgin is haram," he said. "Do you understand? We want you to smash it right now."
He aimed the powerful lamp into Hadi's face and saw his lips move. He moved closer and repeated his order. With difficulty, Hadi moved his lips again.
"I can't. I can't," he said. "Why can't you? You mean you don't want to?" "Look at me. A curse on your fathers. I can't stand up."
The angry officer kicked Hadi in the stomach, winding him completely. One of the assistants went into the room and hit the statue in the wall niche several times with the butt of his pistol, knocking the Virgin's head off. The rest of the statue remained in place. The man pointed the beam of his flashlight at the statue to see the effects of his work. He felt a tremor of fear when he saw the woman peacefully spreading her arms, but without a head. The official mission didn't stop at this point. Before they left, the officer with the bandage wanted to apply a final test to Hadi, the same test he had used with the 11 ugly men they had detained in Batawin earlier that day. The assistants stripped Hadi naked, then examined him in the lamplight to see if there was any stitching on his body or any sign of wounds. The angry officer took out a small sharp knife the length of a finger and cut into Hadi's arms, then his hips and thighs. Hadi cried out. The officer stopped and waited to see the blood. Hadi writhed on the ground as his blood spilled, black and sticky, onto the courtyard floor. It came out in small bursts, then stopped and congealed. It was black blood. The angry officer probed him with his fingers. His colleague didn't move, overcome by a sense of disgust. Why were they doing this? They were collecting information. Why were they stabbing someone for information? Amid the waves of pain, a voice in Hadi's head told him that things would proceed as in an American action movie. His superhero would suddenly appear on the roof in the form of a dark hulk, then come down and at the speed of lightning fell his enemies with powerful punches, saving his friend and creator, his aging father. But that didn't happen. One of the assistants picked up a walkie-talkie and in a low voice summoned the driver. 2 minutes later, everyone left Hadi's house, taking with them the things they had stolen. The officer with the bandage was upset, feeling they hadn't accomplished what they'd come for. Before he reached the door, he turned as if he wanted to go back to beating Hadi, but his colleague pulled him away.
"You worm! You'll be seeing stars again if you're not careful!"
he shouted, looking into the darkness where Hadi's body was sprawled. 5. Abu Anmar was shocked by Faraj's offer. He hadn't expected anything like it. But as he walked the short distance between the door of the Rasul Realty office and that of his hotel, the truth became clearer in his mind. Farage had come up with the cleverest, most cunning way possible to finish off Abu Anmar forever. He had made him an excellent offer. They would be partners. Abu Anmar with the bricks and mortar, the walls and the roof, and Farage with everything else. Farage's share would be more than Abu Anmar's, but Abu Anmar would be in charge of managing and supervising the hotel. The most irritating thing was that Farage wanted to change the name from the Oruba Hotel to the Grand Prophet Hotel. The men argued for a full hour, and in the end, Abu Anmar rejected the offer and went back to his hotel with heavy steps. Despite the heat, he closed the glass door firmly, as if he wanted to drive the image of Farage's office far out of sight. As he sat on his chair behind the reception desk, he set about drinking, calmly and slowly, and flicked through the thick book that contained prophecies of the end of the world. His mind was wandering, retrieving a stream of images from deep in his memory, of his youth and his glory days. He thought about the time when, as a trader traveling between Baghdad and Kalatsukar, a town on the banks of the Garaf Canal in the south, he formed a partnership with the original owner of the hotel, and how after his partner died, he ended up buying the whole hotel. He felt he was standing on the edge of a complete cycle of his life, as he sat there looking at the reflection of his face in the closed door of the hotel. His reflection in the glass door swung away, and the door opened. It was his old friend Hazem Aboud, panting, his face sweaty and a cloth bag hanging heavily from his left shoulder. Hazem had gone through hell to find a taxi to bring him here. He had been threatened by an armed group where he lived, and thought it would be best to spend the night away from home, and maybe other nights too, until he had a clearer picture. Hazem noticed that the hotel seemed almost empty of furniture. Abu Anmar told him about everything he had done in the last few weeks, concluding with the offer that Farage had made that afternoon. Hazem bowed his head a moment, then told him he could always take out a mortgage on the hotel, or get a loan from the government with the hotel as security in order to have it refurbished.
That would mean debts, and who could guarantee the hotel would do well enough to repay them? I would end up falling into a big hole, and then the government would take over the hotel. Things are getting worse and worse.
Then accept Farage's offer.
No, impossible. I will not work under this criminal. I will not let him humiliate me at my age. I was the king in this area when he was renting houses to whores and pimps. I was king.
Abu Anmar leaned down to take a massive photo album from the big drawer in his wooden desk. There were black and white pictures of Abu Anmar in a suit and tie, looking thin and young. In one, he was standing next to a basketball team from Maisan province. In another, sitting next to some short-haired girls who were in a church choir from Mosul. There were pictures of celebrities and people who had once been famous, but who nobody but Abu Anmar seemed to know.
So what will you do? Will you just go on like this till your savings run out?
Asked Hazem.
No, said Abu Anmar, draining the dregs of his drink, filling another glass calmly and slowly, and putting it on the small wooden table in front of his friend. I won't accept that bastard's offer, but I'll make a counter-proposal. I'll sell him the whole hotel.
Chapter 13 The Jewish Ruin 1 Elishva was sitting as usual in the parlor with her shedding cat. Through the thick lenses of her glasses, she was contemplating the picture of the saint, the yellow light of the oil lamp dancing on the picture's ripples, while her ears picked up cries and groans of pain coming from the house next door. The sounds continued for a quarter of an hour. She should have gone to the service to commemorate Saint Shamuni and her seven children on their feast day, but she preferred to stay at home. After Farage had slapped that poor young man, Umm Salim came to see her, and said that Farage was evil, and might do anything. He might forge the title deed to her house and throw her into the street. Besides, no one had ever seen the title deed. Perhaps Elishva didn't even have it. Why was Umm Salim telling her this? Had she turned against her? But she had made her a tempting offer. Elishva could move into a room in Umm Salim's house, and then one of Umm Salim's children could convert Elishva's house into lodgings and rent out the rooms, and the rent money would go to Elishva. Faraj and others who had designs on the old woman would feel she was protected. But that might be a way for Salim to get hold of her house, she thought. Perhaps greed was at work inside the fat old woman, and she was just another wolf in sheep's clothing. Or maybe she was working for Faraj. She didn't respond to Salim's proposal. Salim assumed the feeble-minded old woman needed time to think. But she wasn't thinking about Salim's proposal. That thin young man who wanted to buy her house on behalf of the state? He hadn't understood that she wasn't going to sell her house. She wouldn't feel proud living in a house that belonged to the state when it had once been her house, and the money she would make from selling it would be more than she needed. She shut her eyes a while, and her head felt heavy. Nabu dozed off on her lap, and maybe she, too, was about to fall asleep on the sofa when she heard a noise in the courtyard and the sound of heavy footsteps. She turned toward the door. Standing there was the specter of her son, Daniel. 2. Hadi felt he was dying, but a strong pair of arms picked him up from the broken tiles covered in his sticky blood. He opened his eyes but couldn't see anything. It was completely dark. The arms lowered him gently onto the foam mattress in the middle of the courtyard. A damp cloth ran over his body. Then two dark hands helped him put on his shirt and pants.
Don't worry. You're not going to die. But you deserve this thrashing, the stranger said before disappearing.
A few minutes later, Hadi heard a commotion. He felt a torpor in his limbs and seemed about to fall asleep when flashlights shone on his face.
What do you want from me? What do you want from me?
He shouted, thinking the interrogators had come back, perhaps to finish him off this time.
What have they done to him? One of them said.
They started to turn his body over and inspect his wounds. Abu Salim had noticed the people when they first went into Hadi's house, but couldn't tell what was happening inside. He watched from the balcony till he saw the interrogators come out with some stuff in their hands, then get into the truck and drive off fast. One of them waved out of the truck window a table lamp with a shade made of colored glass and hit it against the wall. Abu Salim went into action, calling some of his children and shouting for some of the young men who lived nearby. They burst into Hadi's house, and when Hadi came round from his delirium, Abu Salim's youngest son ran home to get bandages, disinfectant, medical gauze, and medicine, because he sold such things in a stall in the Shorja market and had considerable knowledge of first aid. He told Hadi that the wounds on his thighs needed stitching, and he wasn't good at that, but he could bandage them up till the morning, and the next day he should go to a nurse or a dispensary to have them stitched, and he shouldn't move too much during the night so his condition didn't deteriorate. They treated him with great decency and compassion, and also tried to find out what had happened. But when they pressed him with questions, Hadi started to swear. He wasn't prepared to go through two interrogations in one evening. A feeble breeze blew down from above into the hollow where Hadi lived between two-story houses with high walls. The drugs that Abu Salim had given him had had an effect, and he regretted his harsh words. But the questions kept coming. Would the interrogators come back? Why did they suddenly stop before getting the answers they wanted? Why did they cut him like that? Who had pointed them in his direction? Was it the journalist? Or one of the customers at Aziz's coffee shop? He didn't yet know that his savings from the hard work he had done over the past week had disappeared, or that the statue of the Virgin Mary had had its head smashed, or that the valuable plates and his most precious possessions had been taken. All that would become clear on the afternoon of the next day. For the moment he felt that everything he had been through had the effect of a powerful slap, maybe from a heavenly hand, to open his eyes to the error of his ways and to the abyss into which he was sliding. He would make a fresh start for himself. He would hold out till his wounds healed completely, and then go to the Sabunji Hammam in Sheikh Omar. He would plant himself like a statue under the hot steam for 3 hours, then shave his head and face and buy smart new clothes and leave this damned Jewish ruin and rent a large airy room in Faraj's new lodgings, then think about renting a shop to buy, sell, and repair used things, because he was good at that. He would find a wife who would put up with him and restrict his drinking to one session a week. He would do all these things and keep doing them if he could sleep peacefully that night, and if he could wake up alive and well in the morning. 3. The what's-its-name didn't think the savage beating and the knife cuts would be enough to kill Hadi. But it looked like the kind of punishment he deserved for his many sins and mistakes. That's what the what's-its-name was thinking as he came down into the courtyard to put his creator on the bed and help him put his clothes on. When he heard the neighbors approaching, he quickly climbed up the stones toward Elishva's house. He found Elishva sitting in the parlor, staring blankly at the picture of St. George the Martyr. She saw him in the doorway, and not a single muscle in her face twitched. She looked at him as if he had been living there for some time and had just come back from the bathroom. He felt lonely. He hadn't spoken to anyone in weeks. He had only two acquaintances left, the junk dealer and the mad old woman. He could have finished off the pink officers and their three assistants without batting an eyelid, but that would have created a bigger problem for the junk dealer, who would be accused of killing them. In order to help Hadi resume his normal life, he had better not show his face to him again. The what's-its-name was now at a loss for what to do. He knew his mission was essentially to kill new people every day. But he no longer had a clear idea who should be killed or why. The flesh of the innocents, of which he was initially composed, had been replaced by new flesh, that of his own victims and criminals. He thought if he took too long avenging the victims in whose name he was acting, the body parts he had taken from them would decompose in situ. It would be the end of him, and he would be free of this world. But he wasn't sure this was the right choice either. He had to stay alive until he worked out what his next steps should be. And because he was an exceptional killer who wouldn't die by traditional means, he thought he should exploit this distinctive talent in the service of the innocent, in the service of truth and justice. Until he was sure of his next steps, he would concentrate on ensuring his own survival. He would salvage the spare parts he needed from the bodies of those who deserved to be killed. It wasn't the ideal option, but it was the best one possible for now. The what's-its-name explained some of his worries to the old woman. She was listening and stroking the back of her old sleeping cat. She didn't seem capable of understanding such a complicated subject, but she was someone who would listen, and that's what the what's-its-name needed at the moment. He told her he sometimes ran into some of his followers who were on the run after surviving the minor civil war they had fought at the barracks in the shell of the building in Dora. The way they treated him depended on which of the three madmen they had followed, and they didn't seem to have lost much of their faith in him. One night he saw Citizen 341 walking down the street in the Wazaria district. He bowed to the what's-its-name and kissed his hand. The man said he had no idea what had happened to the other numbers, who had been killed, and who had survived the terrible bullet fest that night. Also, although he still believed and had a deep desire to reorganize, he had no idea who Citizen 342 was, or Citizen 340, or where they would resume counting if they gained new supporters and believers, or which numbers were now vacant and how many citizens there really were now. Another night he had some serious putrefaction problems and ran into a follower who believed he was the savior. The man took him to his house in the Fadl district, avoiding the neighbors and prying eyes. When they were in the courtyard, this believer went into the kitchen and came back with a large knife. He told the what's-its-name he could kill him and take the parts he needed. The offer took the what's-its-name by surprise. After thinking for a few minutes, he decided it was a good idea, especially as the alternatives would cause much more commotion, and he might have to kill off many people before he managed to replace the worn-out parts with fresh new ones. He cut the man's arteries at the wrists, so he died slowly, and went into a coma before he gave up the ghost. He didn't want to stab him in the stomach or cut his throat, because that would seem violent, and this believer, or anyone else in the same situation, wouldn't be able to control himself and the animal instincts of his body. He might scream, or maybe decide on impulse to fight back against the death that was coursing through his body. Elishva kept listening to what she thought was the specter of her son who had disappeared 2 decades ago, without giving any sign that she understood what he was saying. It was getting late for the old woman, and she had a feeling her visitor might go on talking till the morning. If there was anything of her son in him, he ought to understand that she was holding out against death, and she wouldn't give advice that promoted any kind of death.
"Why don't you relax, my boy?" she said,
wanting to put an end to his long ramble.
"Shall I make up a bed for you in the courtyard?"
He felt she was reminding him of the role she had played in shaping his identity. He also felt that in other circumstances he would really like to accept her offer, to lie down on a low cotton mattress and look at the square patch of sky, counting the stars till he fell asleep. But that was a life that wasn't his. She took off her glasses, rubbed her eyes, took a deep breath, and let out a long sigh. When she opened her eyes again, her talkative visitor was nowhere to be found. She looked at the picture of the saint hanging in front of her, his lance raised and the dragon crouching beneath him. She wondered why he hadn't killed the dragon years ago. Why was he stuck in that posture, ready to strike, she wondered. Everything remains half-completed, exactly like now. She wasn't exactly a living being, but not a dead one either.
"You're tormenting me," she said,
picking up the sleeping cat and putting it beside her on the sofa. The cat opened his eyes, gave a long yawn, and stretched.
"You haven't killed this dragon, have you, you warrior?" she said,
then waited patiently for his answer. She stood up, still staring into the handsome face of the silent saint.
"Everything will come to an end, Elishva." "Why the hurry?" said the saint, his lips not moving in the slightest.
Nothing in the picture moved, and yet she could hear his voice clearly. 4. Hadi lay awake, looking up at the square of blue sky above and the birds darting past. He closed his eyes a while, then opened them again and caught sight of the silhouette of an American helicopter flying past, making a thunderous whacking noise. He wanted to get up, but he didn't think he had the strength. Then suddenly his whole body convulsed at the sound of a powerful blast and the ground shaking beneath him. It was a car bomb in the Sadria district, several miles from Badawin in the heart of the old capital. But Hadi didn't find out anything about the explosion till late in the day. He sat on his bed, his body throbbing with pain, and then he heard a movement at the front door of the house. It was Aziz the Egyptian, with two young men from the neighborhood. Aziz swore as he shoved the temperamental door closed, then gave Hadi a broad smile and approached with a bowl of clotted cream, some bread, and a thermos of tea.
"Thank God you're safe," said Aziz, patting his friend on the shoulder.
Less than an hour later, the young man who worked with Hadi showed up. He had an appointment to deal with the rest of the stuff from the old hotel, and was taken aback to see Hadi tied up in bandages. After breakfast, Aziz encouraged Hadi to inspect his house. Hadi was shocked to discover that his savings and some valuables were missing. At first he suspected the people who had dressed his injuries, but then his suspicions shifted to the interrogators. Seeing the damaged statue of the Virgin, Aziz looked upset.
"That's the Mother of Jesus. Why would anyone do that?" he asked,
touching the broken pieces of plaster, then brushing his hand as if he didn't want to get involved in any accidental sabotage. Hadi felt sick when he remembered all the money he had made from selling the furniture from the Aruba Hotel that had now gone missing. An hour later he came to his senses. He told his assistant to go buy some polish, nails, sandpaper, wood filler, and other things for preserving and maintaining old furniture. They would work on the battered old wardrobes, then take them to market and sell them as soon as possible. When everyone was gone, Hadi noticed the plaster icon of the Virgin. He used to wonder whether it might be possible to get it free in one piece and sell it to a church. He pulled out smashed parts of the icon, then looked at the hole that the statue had left in the wall, and brushed aside the dust to reveal a dark wooden plank 2 feet high and a foot wide. He wiped it again and uncovered an engraving in the shape of a tree. In fact, it was a large candelabra, with writing above and below, in what Hadi soon realized was Hebrew. When he was younger, he had seen similar things on the walls of some of the houses in Badawin, and he immediately thought this, too, was something he could sell. When this occurred to him, He felt a pang of fear, thinking of the interrogators. He remembered his resolutions of the previous night and made up his mind to change everything. Hadi heard something at the door. His assistant must have come back from the market. He dragged a folded rug from the corner of the room and propped it up against the wall in front of the statue niche and the wooden plank, hiding them completely. 5. Nader Shamuni, the deacon, had trouble reaching Elishva's house. The Americans had blocked the road at Tehran Square because of a car bomb close to the Gilani gas station and another explosion in the Sadria market that had killed dozens of shoppers and shopkeepers. Nader wanted to get out of his car, but a policeman warned him that he couldn't park there. He thought about calling Father Josiah to tell him he couldn't complete his mission. But wiser counsel told him it might be like this every day. He should complete his mission, whatever it took, especially as he wasn't going to have problems like this often in the days to come. He had decided to leave Baghdad with his family. He had told Father Josiah a long time ago, but kept postponing the move, realizing he would be leaving his home, his neighbors, and his life in Baghdad, to move to Ankawa at the behest of his daughters and relatives who had been living there for several years. When the move was still tentative, Nader discovered one morning that the keyhole of his front door had been filled with some kind of glue. He tried to remove the glue, but wound up having to replace the lock. Before a week had passed, he discovered that the new lock had been filled with the same sticky substance. Someone was harassing them, he told his family, probably just some kid, and he decided not to repair the lock and to make do with bolting the door from the inside. But he found the lock on the door leading from the kitchen to the garden had also been filled with the sticky substance. Angry and tense, he called a quick family meeting. At first he suspected his daughters and his wife, but soon dismissed that idea. Someone must have climbed the fence and come in when they were asleep. Many similar incidents had taken place over the past 3 years, and given the deteriorating security situation in Baghdad, there was no authority that could be trusted to help him. The father of one family in the congregation had recently been abducted. The family persuaded the kidnappers to free him only by paying a large ransom. Nader called his brothers and relatives in Ankawa and told them of his decision.
"It's a temporary measure. We'll leave home till things calm down in the capital," he said.
He didn't foresee the possibility that never coming back would become a very real option. Nader parked his small Volga at the end of the lane and walked to Elishva's house. He wouldn't see her again, he reckoned, and that was reason enough to make his last meeting with her more friendly. He had known her and her late husband and her children for decades, and could see that the old woman was tired. She had new lines on her face and around her eyes behind the big glasses she wore. Maybe he noticed all this because he hadn't sat so close to her for a long time. She hadn't been to church in about a month. Elishva's daughters, Hilda and Matilda, kept calling Father Josiah, and he kept assuring them that their mother was healthy and safe. But they asked to hear her voice. They knew she was angry, and they wanted to make up with her. Nader told her all this and said that the priest was asking her to come see him next Sunday after Mass. Elishva just scowled.
"Matilda's going to come to Iraq for you," Nader continued. "She said she'd come see you and then take you back with her."
"She won't do it. She's a coward."
"She will do it. She was crying during her conversation with Father Josiah."
"I'm not going anywhere. I won't leave my house."
"But what use is the house, Daniel? What use is it when you're alone, like someone sitting in a tent in the desert?"
"My family are here, and my neighbors. My life is in this house."
"I know, but don't you miss your daughters?"
"They're fine. Why are they asking me to leave my house?"
"Well, you know, life's getting hard here. What use is the house if life is hard? Fear, death, anxiety, criminals in the street, everyone watching as you walk past. Even when you're asleep, it's nightmares and jumping in fright all the time. The whole country's starting to look like the Jewish ruin next door."
"Fear not those who kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul."
"Yes," replied Nader, who had no ready reply to the biblical reference.
Without intending to, he started to share his own personal worries.
"You must come on Sunday, for my sake, Daniel. If you like, I'll come and pick you up. Would that be okay?"
She agreed. In the 3 days before Sunday, Nader was consumed with preparations. He had listed his house with a realtor and sold much of his furniture, storing the rest on the upper floor. He was so busy that he didn't even attend Mass on Sunday. On Monday morning, he left the house keys with a friend, asked him to arrange for the things in the storeroom to be sent to Erbil by truck, and set off with his family in his small Volga, bound for the north. He either forgot about or deliberately ignored the old lady. From the way she looked, he thought, she might not last another year, and he would never see her again. For her part, Elishva didn't think she would see the deacon with the Turkish mustache ever again either. But both of them were wrong. Chapter 14 Tracking and Pursuit 1 Brigadier Majid was in his office watching Fareed Shawaf speak on television about Criminal X, as the journalists were now calling the one who has no name. The television channels were covering the criminal almost every day, showing identikit drawings of his face, with the caption stating the reward for anyone who provided information leading to his arrest. If he could arrest this nameless criminal, the brigadier thought, it would be the crowning glory of several years' efforts. The criminal was a television star, and when the brigadier caught him, he too would immediately become a celebrity. "They're offering money they know very well they'll never have to pay out," Brigadier Majid told one of his junior officers. He felt instantly that this was the kind of sentence the well-dressed man on television might have said. The man who always wore suits the brigadier coveted but knew he would never wear as long as he was stuck in his office at the tracking and pursuit department. He took a small mirror out of his desk drawer and studied the black rings under his eyes and the way his face sagged. He wiped his face with the palm of his hand, something he did habitually, but only when he was alone in the office. For the last 3 years, his work had been proceeding without great surprises. With his eccentric assistants, he drafted predictions about explosions on the streets of Baghdad, picked up rumors and analyzed them, provided confidential advice to politicians who were forming alliances for the coming elections, or thinking about entering into business partnerships. He would get upset when his rank and military career were ignored, and someone from government headquarters would call him after midnight to ask how to interpret some dream. He spent much of his time on such nonsense. In the golden age when life was easy, before the criminal without a name appeared, he had sometimes been taken by surprise by a visit from a prominent politician. Their names were all the same to him, and they would ask him many questions, as if he was the one who could read the tea leaves and foretell the future. But he knew there was only one question that brought them all the way to his office. "When and how will I die?" It usually came at the end of an exhausting list of questions, to give the impression that it was just one of many. "Should I order an armor-plated car, or don't I need one?" one of the politicians once asked him. His parliamentary bloc had been assigned only 3 armor-plated cars, the politician explained. Should he fight to obtain one? Anyone else in his place would have exploited these politicians to promote himself, to try to obtain a more senior position, and escape being trapped in the tracking and pursuit department. But Brigadier Majid wanted to demonstrate his worth through real effort, not by telling the fortunes of politicians, but by arresting criminals. All this changed, though, with the appearance of the dangerous criminal. Fareed Shawaf had disappeared from the television screen, and the news had come on, when one of the officers took the brigadier by surprise with a terrifying idea that Majid had never thought of before. "If bullets really don't kill him, and he knows we're trying to track him down, what if he followed us, found our headquarters, and then came here to wipe us all out?" 2. The senior astrologer was pondering the same question as he turned over the playing cards in the room he shared with the junior astrologer. He shuffled them again, like a skilled poker player, then drew a single card and held it right in front of his eyes. He stared at it as if he could see in it a deep chasm or a door that opened onto a whole world only he could see. He knew that one day he would come face to face with the criminal and would recognize him. But for the moment, the face was vague and refused to take shape. He stroked his long